Hello and welcome to another edition of Key to Happiness with me, Rob Saunders. It's show number 8 and on today's show we have a Dr. Susie Edge from the UK. She's a doctor based in Scotland and we'll be introducing her very shortly. Now this podcast is for educational purposes only. Works for me, may not work for everybody, but I find it absolutely fantastic and invigorating. If you are embarking on a new lifestyle, please contact your professional doctor, physician, healthcare assistant, whoever. But make sure you're starting on the right track. And if you do want to start the keto way of lifestyle, take a look at my friends, the Two Keto Dudes, at start.2keto.com. And they'll show you the ins and outs and how to start the keto lifestyle. We'll be joined by Susie very shortly. She's a doctor based in Scotland and has a first degree in molecular and cell biology, but now she's an actual doctor in a hospital. We'll be back very shortly with Susie. And you're back with me, Rob, and I'm here with Susie Edge. Now, just a bit of a biog on Susie. She's a doctor based in Scotland in the UK, and after a degree in molecular and cell biology, she went on to study medicine and now works in the Department of Trauma and Orthopaedic Surgery. She also recently completed a Master's in Modern History, studying military medical hierarchies in the 19th century. She was introduced to the low-carb diets by her brother, who gave her a copy of Gary Taub's book, The Diet Delusion, back in 2009. And for the sort of last 10 years, she didn't really commit, and she felt like everybody thought it was mad. Been there, done that. And she would read around it and try it here and there for a few days, always go back to this standard diet. She ate lots of low-fat foods and calorie counted, and despite being into rugby, karate, and being in the territorial army, she was fit but put on more and more weight. Eventually, there was a moment where she decided enough was enough and ditched the carbs and started reading. By now, there was a lot, as we know, listeners, there's a large online low carb community which is built up and helps ever so much. And a year on, she's 35 pounds down, feeling the benefits. She's also a fan of intermittent fasting, massively frustrated for so many of her patients who need hip and knee replacements, but could benefit for so much more help with respect to diet and nutrition. Welcome, Susie.
Hello, Rob. Thanks so much for asking me on for a chat. I'm really looking forward to it.
Oh, it's a pleasure. So you started, technically you started your journey 10 years ago, but
yeah.
but just sort of you just dipped in and out of things, probably like me. You know, I did the low-fat diets, the calorie counting and all that type of thing. But was there a significant point where you thought, sod this, I'm going to do this now?
Definitely there was, yeah. I mean, as you say, 10 years. It seems mad now looking back that it took that long. But I did dip in and out because I'd read that book and, you know, there wasn't a lot around 10 years ago to go and find and do as we do now. You know, we weren't listening to these sorts of podcasts then.
Yeah.
So there wasn't really any support. And I thought everyone thinks this is nuts. And so I didn't really follow it that well. And it certainly wasn't something that we were advocating for our patients. So why would I do it myself?
Yeah.
But yeah, this time last year or just sort of after Christmas last year, I was snowboarding with my family, or at least I was snowboarding and they were skiing, and I couldn't keep up with them. And I tried to get on a pommel with my snowboard and actually fell off and landed in a big heap. And at that point I realized I couldn't bend over and undo the bindings on my snowboard because I'd got so big. And there were lots of people in this queue waiting to get on the pommel behind me. All the skiers, all these really fit skiers were looking at me and shaking their heads. And I just thought, this is crazy. What's happened to me? Because I've always been pretty fit.
Yeah.
I've always been able to do all those things. And my weight never really affected any of those things.
Sure.
And that's probably why in the past I didn't really fully commit, because my weight wasn't affecting anything. Or at least I didn't think it was.
Yeah.
Obviously now looking back, there's so many other things that come into it. It's not just about weight, is it? But you don't realize that at the time. Everything's about weight. And that time really was about the weight. And I thought, I've got to do something about this. So there really was a day one which is, we were just talking about this, it's almost exactly a year ago.
Yeah, and it's my Keetaversary this week as well, so.
Yeah, we're year-long twinnies.
Yeah, I know, that's amazing. Now, what is brilliant, it's you're my first sort of person with medical background. And
right, okay.
Obviously, I've had, you know, people coming in that's they're experts in their own field. They promote different types of low carb or different types of wellness, health and well-being. Mm-hmm. But I'd love to get your opinion on, for one, the recommendations that's still going on with the American and the UK diet, respectively. I think the American was 77 and they're still working off the UK one, which I think was 82, 83. Now, are you still finding that in your case, or have some other doctors, stroke GPs, family doctors, as well as people like yourself that could see the benefit that such a lifestyle change can make to somebody's health and mobility, I suppose, in your profession?
Yeah. I think it's really, really interesting in the UK. We seem to have a little bit more leeway with what's going on. And I say that because you look at the likes of people like Dr. David Unwin and what he's doing in his practice with diabetes.
Yeah.
And he's coming at it from a diabetes point of view, but a lot of the results that he's having are also to do with weight loss and depression and hypertension and these things which you can come off medication for if you can get those under control. And one thing that was really cool, actually, was I heard David Unwin say, and it really settled my nerves a lot, was that actually if you go back and look at what we call the NICE guidelines, the Institute of Clinical Excellence guidelines, it does say when it talks about treating diabetes that one could use a low glycemic index in order to treat diabetes. Okay. And so therefore that gives us a bit of an in, actually, to say, well, this is what we're doing. In terms of my own work and where I am and what I see, there's very little of that going on. I think, you know, I don't work in general practice, so I don't have one-to-one time with patients like that. I've spoken myself on my own podcast to a few different GPs, and they say they are beginning to get these things in, and they're beginning to talk about low-carb diets or the options of intermittent fasting, and they're really beginning to see changes. And then we look at likes of the Public Health Collaboration Conference and all the GPs that came together for that. Yeah. And it's really positive. And then I went to a conference myself back in September. There were 250 of us, mostly GPs and the odd strange orthopod like me. And, you know, and it really was very, very positive. But there's still a lot of backlash and a lot of, you know, sideways looks. And actually, at the end of the day, what we feed our patients when they're in hospital and what we feed residents in nursing homes and what we feed staff in the large institutions like the National Health Service, what we feed people in prisons, what we feed our children in schools are all still based on those guidelines. So the difference is we've got two different populations, haven't we? We've got the population, say our kids, who aren't considered unwell, but we're feeding them this way in this guideline kind of way.
Yeah.
And then we've got this other population, this sick population who perhaps need this help more and or maybe the same, I don't know. But I think that we need to separate those two out. So when it comes to guidelines, are we talking about guidelines for very unwell, sick type 2 diabetics who are just about to lose limbs and kidneys and eyesight?
Yeah.
Or are we talking about our children in schools who've got the next 40 years to get to the position that you and I found ourselves in a year ago.
Sure.
And they're two really different things. And I think they're kind of going in different directions almost.
Yeah. And
or rather the one isn't moving at all. That's and the other one is having sort of slight indents.
High science, a lovely thing, but you know, I don't remember much in my 20s because I was in my 20s and I worked for a brewery. But and you don't think of that until, you know, like you had that moment with the snowboard that I had the moment where I'm bending down, putting socks on, as simple as that, you know, and creaking, that type of thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know if sort of genetic history or whatever, but my family has sort of got a history of rheumatoid arthritis, and on my mum's side is heart disease. So, you know, and until I sort of started reading like yourself and sort of taking advice from other people. And I must admit, hand on heart, I haven't been to see my GP yet. Apart from seeing him in the pub and he's just smiling at me, just nodding. But yeah, it's and you mentioned the conferences where GPs and, you know, cardiologists, people like yourself, are turning up and getting the knowledge from these brilliant minds. And all we need, a bit like what, if anybody's watched anything by Tim Noakes, the confidence to say, yeah, we got it wrong.
Yeah.
That's the it's a bit like politics that they're happening at the moment. Yeah, we got it wrong. Let's start again, you know. So
that issue of pride or saving face is going to be a massive one, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I've heard ages ago the two keto dudes talking in a podcast. I'm not sure who they were talking to. It may well have been Tim Noakes, but I'm not sure. But really the idea came, they were discussing the fact that maybe there's going to have to be some sort of line in the sand or some sort of idea that we can not, how do I put it? Are you still there?
Yeah.
I've lost you for a moment.
Yeah, no worries.
Yeah, that maybe we can come to an agreement that anybody now changing their mind or saying, I've changed my mind, I was wrong, isn't going to be prosecuted or persecuted for it.
Exactly, yeah.
And that's maybe going to have to happen. Who knows how? I mean, I have no idea.
No.
The whole thing's just a massive sprawling beast, isn't it? And
it is, and people do, you know, a lot of people that are looking out for you thinking, oh my God, Rob, Susie, you're eating fat. And yeah. You know, and I say, you know, it's good fat. It's not the rubbish that you get in, you know, processed food. It's stuff that your grandma and grandpa used to eat, and you know, the basic red meats and the good, you know, Welsh lamb and things like that. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and I must admit, I have introduced a few carbs here and there, but they're the good ones. They're the broccolis and the cauliflowers of this world, and nuts and things like that. And I've become a bit of a foodie since I've been doing this as well.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, so, yeah, it is interesting. And you know, the fact that the UK and obviously we've got some listeners all over the world, other medical bodies are sort of taking it on board. And I don't know if you've watched... or looked at what Zoe Harcum and Tom Watson and Asim Malhotra was discussing in the House of Commons a few weeks ago with Deputy Leader Tom Watson. That was so inspiring. Obviously, the UK's in a bit of a flux at the moment, but that sort of put a smile on my face that something is happening and people are listening.
I think that was great. I've only actually seen so far Tom Watson's speech there.
Yeah.
And it's on my to-do list to see what Asim Malhotra and Zoe Harcum had to say.
Yeah.
One of the things that struck me after that, actually, was how many, you know, I don't just watch things like that. I like to see what people are saying about them as well.
Yeah.
So I went to Twitter and I had a look, and there was an awful lot of pushback and a lot of people saying, oh, you know, why aren't the dietitians there? Why aren't we asking proper clinical experts? And I just think, oh, you know, guys, we've got time for that. That'll come.
Yeah, it will.
But what I think, I totally agree that it's there. And Tom Watson's been instrumental in bringing that to the fore, and fantastic for him. And, you know, people turn around and say, well, what's he got to say about it? He's not a nutritionist. He's not a politician. He is a politician. He's only a politician. He hasn't done 4 years at university studying dietetics. No, so what?
Yeah, he's worn the T-shirt. He's walked the walk.
too right he has. And he's now realised that he's got a platform to go out there and to start having conversations and to bring people, other people in who can join those conversations. And if he can do that, that's absolutely brilliant. And I absolutely applaud him. I really do. Yeah. I know you've thought about asking him, or I don't know if you've asked him to come on the show, and he's obviously got his hands a little bit full.
And I've got a friend of a friend who's an MP. He's sort of trying to get him on. But I'll wait till things blow over a little bit, and touch wood, we'll get him on. But if you get a chance to watch Zoe Harcombe's presentation, it's on the if on YouTube, if you look for Ivor Cummins and the Fat Emperor.
He recorded it, didn't he?
Yeah. He recorded it all, and it's fascinating. And it's and she goes to a lot of the facts that people sort of dismiss about fat and how the history of, you know, low carb, high fat has come a buzzword, but it's been going on for years and years for treating other conditions, as we know.
I think it's going to take a really long time because even now, I mean, you and I are sort of immersed in that world at the moment, and we're hearing all that going on, and it sounds very exciting. Yep. And it feels like, you know, the future is here now. We're getting somewhere. But then, you know, I go to work and I spend all of my day on a ward with lots of nurses.
Yeah.
We sit around, we have lunch together. I go and have a cup of tea with them, and I can have long conversations because they ask me, they say, what are you doing? Because actually I've lost 35 pounds or 2.5 stone. But it's actually really dramatic, my weight loss. If you see photos of me before, my body composition has changed quite dramatically. So, you know, at work, people are saying, what have you done? What are you doing? And I start these conversations and they can go on for the whole lunchtime, everybody putting in their thing. And then somebody will say, oh, but what I'm eating is fine because it's low fat. And I just I leave with my head in my hands because I think, well, nobody has listened to what I've just said. It's really, really hard. And you know, these are people that I work with. They're all healthcare professionals. And I just wish there was more of an open mind from people to say, why has that worked for you? Rather than being so dismissive.
Yeah. I put on a little graphic on a few weeks ago on Instagram or Facebook that, you know, people are worried for me because I'm eating all this fat. I'm lost 4.5 stone. I'm doing, you know, running. I'm going to the gym and everything like that. But they didn't bat an eyelid when I was eating 6 donuts at once and a, you know, double helping of a McDonald's and things like that. And it is, and
it's so true.
It is, and must be your physio. I have looked at the before and after pictures, and you look so younger now.
People keep saying that to me. Yeah, it's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's all this idea of autophagy, isn't it? And I'm in a Facebook group full of doctors, women who are mums, who are all got together because they wanted to lose weight. And there's a lot of conversations about keto diets and intermittent fasting. And one of the funny things everybody says is, oh, my elbows are really smooth. What's happened? This is a standing joke with us all now. We've got really smooth elbows, but you know, these things are just tiny little things, but they all add up, don't they?
Yeah.
But here's the thing, right? If you meet somebody in the street, or I meet a patient who's got a really healthy height to weight ratio, or dare we say it, healthy normal BMI, who, you know, has amazing blood sugar control, great HbA1c, perfect lipid profile, you know, doesn't have any inflammatory complaints. You know, he isn't suffering from depression, all these things. And you look at them and you say, oh, fantastic. Well done. You're a really healthy specimen. You're going to live long and prosper. Well done. Mm. And then somebody says to you, but look at the same person. And a year ago, they were, you know, quite a few pounds more heavier than that. And they had problems controlling their blood sugars, and they were taking diabetes medications, they were taking antihypertensive pills, they were taking, you know, omeprazole, stomach protectors, and all these drugs, and now they're not taking them anymore.
Yeah.
And they've managed to get on top of those things. And oh my God, all of a sudden everyone's saying, you're going to drop down dead imminently, you're going to have a heart attack. That's crazy. That doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever. Now, because you think that I've changed that by having a ketogenic way of eating over the last year, that suddenly my prognosis is worse. When 10 minutes ago you looked at all those things and you said, well done, I was a healthy specimen. That doesn't make any sense to me.
It doesn't at all.
It absolutely drives me potty.
I'm getting
and I had this, sorry, yeah. I'm on a rant now.
No, carry on, please.
I was sitting at a dinner. I'd been at a conference, actually, and I was sitting next to a doctor, a GP, who had slightly differing views to mine. She was plant-based and she wasn't very happy about the steak that I was eating. Mm. And we got talking about the differences I'd made to my health, not just in terms of weight, but in terms of the medications that I no longer take, the fact that I can now keep up with my children doing martial arts, which is just awesome. You know, I couldn't have done that a year ago and all these things. And she said, that's wonderful for you. Well done. I'm really glad that you've lost weight. And I'm really glad that all these markers look wonderful. And I'm really glad that you've dropped your risk of diabetes and all the complications that come with diabetes. But I think what you're doing is really dangerous because we've got no data about how ketogenic diets are going to pan out in the long term.
And you think,
I just, you know, I couldn't believe what I was hearing. Great. Okay, I get it. All right.
Yeah.
The thing is about long-term data, just because we don't have it, you can't say it's, yeah, you can't say it's dangerous. You can't say it's safe either. You can't say it's anything because we don't have it.
Yeah.
But what we absolutely can say, if you look back at me a year ago, weighing 16 and a half stone with all those problems that I have, that I did have an increased risk of diabetes and all the complications associated with it. And I did have a higher risk of cardiovascular disease, stroke, and, you know, some cancers associated with obesity. I did have all those risks then. And now you're saying I don't, but what I'm doing is dangerous.
Yeah.
What are we talking about here?
Yeah.
And she was absolutely closed to the question of why.
Yeah.
Can't we have the discussion why? You know, we're all good at things like physiology and, you know, can't we just sit down and discuss why? And that's, you really got me going there. Sorry.
Oh, no, you're right. I was going to say about the physiological thing where people are saying, Rob, don't lose that. Don't lose any more. And I think, why not? I feel brilliant. Yeah. You know, I've got my little goals, you know, I've got my little walk into next and put a pair of 32 inch jeans on, that type of thing. All the sort of the ego thing, I don't mind it. You know, it's making me, you know, grateful for what I've been doing for me and the family, sort of thing. So I think stop there. But I don't know about yourself, but I tend to be a bit over the top with it if I like get on a rant and things like that.
Sorry.
No, I don't make any excuses for it because I'm the most evangelical person of it since I've sort of started sort of spreading the love. Yeah.
And it's great. And I think what you're doing as well in the UK is really cool because I listen like you to a lot of podcasts all around the world. It's great low carb MD guys in America.
Yeah,
you know, Sean Baker and what he's doing and all the others, they're great. The two keto dudes in the US, Australia. But yeah, it's nice to hear a UK perspective.
Yeah, that's what I mainly thought, because the guy that really put me onto the keto dudes and Jimmy Moore and all them type of people was my first guest, Jack Black. And he sort of, because of the what he does for a living, he just inspired me to think, just use a different part of your brain and just make your logical brain, you know, project into your creative one and just create yourself being 4 stone lighter that way. And just there's ways and means of doing it. And the first one was me saying, okay, I'm not going to have a pint of Guinness tonight. And that was March the 10th. And bear in mind, it's a week before St. Patrick's Day. And I was in Dublin at the time. So, and what I did, I said, I'm going to have a burger. But I'm going to have halloumi fries and not eat the bun. And that's what started me. And then I've been sort of MasterChef and whatever, you know, going on. So, but yeah, it's it is interesting. And back to the data thing. Because there's data on, you know, the high carb diets and things like that. And a lot of the data that I've been reading is, I can't remember the word because it's that long, endocrinological, which is basically a survey based rather than, because obviously medical trials are really expensive. So they take a lot of data over 20 years and people say, what did you have to eat on February the 5th, 2006? And people are expected. And obviously with, I've done it myself, with questionnaires, you tend to either over or under exaggerate some of the questions. So what are your thoughts on the sort of the papers that are out there that you may have come across that you think, oh, they're a bit not dodgy, but we should think a bit more about them?
I think when it comes to nutrition, it's really very difficult because we can't do, you know, we can't blind ourselves or our cohort to anything.
Yeah.
Okay. We know what we're eating, yeah, and we know what we choose to eat. And that makes it very, very difficult to then design, in effect, the perfect trial for these things.
Yeah.
So what we're left with is perhaps the imperfect. There's been a lot of slagging off of epidemiological studies, and for the reasons you just said, and I totally get it, because quite often we're ending up with causations which is perhaps not right, and it's more to do with correlations. And it's really, really tricky, yeah, isn't it? Because then what have you got to go on?
Yeah.
You've got your epidemiological stuff. You can't really do double-blind randomized control trials. That's really difficult. And even if you could take people into an isolated ward environment and give them nothing else but what you can control, that actually still doesn't represent the real world, mm-hmm, where, you know, I walk past our staff room every 5 minutes and there's chocolates on the desk shouting, sure, my name. You know, that doesn't represent the real world. So where do all the other aspects come into it when you suddenly isolate people to try and create the perfect trial?
Yep.
And so what are you left with? What are you left with isn't perfect. It's really not great indeed. One thing I think is really concerning, and we're not taking into account enough, is that clinical experience actually does matter.
Yeah.
And when you think about evidence-based medicine was never originally just about what you could read in that fancy journal. It was that plus clinical experience. And so when people are starting to have a go at what David Unwin's doing because he's not, you know, having these massive randomized control trials over different centers and all the rest,
yeah,
they're missing the fact that he's actually on the front line doing the work, looking after real people,
sure,
with real life problems, and seeing their families see the results of that.
Yeah.
And so you've got to bring all that together. And, you know, there are so many other factors involved. Like so here's the thing. I have started on my low carb diet in this time last year. And it was going absolutely swimmingly, really well. But in October last year, I had an accident and smashed my wrist to pieces.
Okay.
I really did a cracking job on it. And I had to have an operation on that, and it's taken a very long time to rehab. Only now am I able to do press-ups, which has been a real, real drag. But I can do it now. But it's taken that long.
Yeah.
And in that time, my mind was not there. Mm-hmm. My mind wasn't on the stakes. And I was turning to the other stuff because there was this other thing that was distracting me. There was pain. There was an inability, yeah, to drive, look after my family, do the exercise that I wanted to do. There was this other factor that was getting in the way. At that point, I turned to intermittent fasting and actually managed to maintain my weight by, okay, you know, not eating for 18 hours a day,
yeah,
or more. What was my point? My point was that there are so many other factors involved for so many people,
yeah,
that deciding what the world is going to eat based on what people said they may or may not have eaten on the 5th of February 2012 is utterly crazy.
It is, like, yeah.
But it's all we've got to go on.
Yeah.
So what do we do? Do we ignore it? What I think we need to do more of is education of interpreting the results.
Yeah.
Because actually, you know, you look at the likes of meat consumption and the you know, the likelihood of meat causing bowel cancer, it's actually like really low. It's like 1.18% if you have a bunch of meat every day for the next 40 years.
But that you could have the same result if you eat, you know, a packet of boiled sweets for the same amount of time. You know,
I've had someone say to me, if I can't possibly eat that for breakfast every day because of the risk of bowel cancer associated with it, which is what, 1.18%. And I say to them, well, what's the risk of you eating Cheerios,
yeah,
every morning instead?
Yeah.
What's the risk of you eating that muffin? Yeah. Actually, the risks are probably far worse in terms of the likelihood of developing obesity and diabetes, etc.
Yeah.
So you've got to pick your worst. But of course, that's not going to be the headline, is it? The headline is going to be meat causes cancer.
Yeah. And it's sensationalism in journalism.
Sensationalism,
yeah.
Absolutely. And there's nothing I like more than a cracking headline. I mean, you know, I love reading language like that. You mentioned earlier, I did a master's in history not so long ago, and yeah, I spent ages trawling through these really old editions of The Lancet and reading the language and the headlines, and they're absolutely fantastic. Yeah. Some of the stuff that they'd come out with to grab people's attention.
Oh, I didn't realise they did that in a something like The Lancet. I thought it was all the tabloids that would do that sort of thing.
The Lancet's really interesting, actually, because it was started up. I can't remember the guy's name. I'll have to go back and look it up. I wrote loads about this. But it was started up by someone who was a doctor who wanted to go against the establishment because he thought all the doctors were all up to no good and it was all corrupt and they were all sort of looking after number one and helping each other. He didn't like that. So he set it up as a antagonistic paper to go against the grain, against what everyone was saying. And I think that's really funny now because it seems to be completely the opposite, doesn't it?
Oh, amazing. Yeah. And I was having this conversation, exactly the same conversation, we're just with a friend who I'm just trying to get onto keto. But again, last episode, I had my wife on. We were on holiday. We were in Florida and I brought all the equipment, a little mini studio thing and mixer and stuff. And we just got onto the fact of convincing our sort of dear friends and family that, yeah, we're not in a suicide cult together, that we're eating each other to death, you know, sort of thing. And but the other thing which I was going to ask on behalf of Sian was, and I think Daisy Brackenhall answered the question as well, is I've had amazing results on a low carb regime, but Sian's getting the health and the well-being of it, but the weight is not as fast as, you know, me as fat bloke from Wales as I used to be. Yeah. So what are your thoughts on the different physiology, male, female?
I think there's clearly differences in how people respond to these diets. And we're seeing it anecdotally from, as you say, from Daisy. If you listen to Daisy's podcast over the last year, there's so many women will be saying similar things.
Yeah.
There's a guy, is it Jay Wrigley? A family physician.
Okay.
I think he's American. If you're wanting to know more about that in terms of physiology, female physiology, especially around menopause time.
You sure?
And he talks about polycystic ovarian syndrome and things like that really well, really nicely. And I feel like actually that if anyone does ask me that question, then I kind of direct them to him and what he's got to say, because he's got a lot to say about it like that. And I haven't actually massively looked into it. I know my own personal experience has been, I've not lost 100 pounds. I've not had 100 pounds to lose, to be fair.
Yeah.
But a lot of the other benefits in terms of my, you know, female physiology and my cycles of my mood monthly and things like that have been outstanding. I'm just a different person.
That's amazing.
And I would rather be that person and the weight I am than lose the weight that I still want to lose to get to a goal. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah. We talked about being, not everybody wants to be Lee Hemsworth, Thor, or Kim Kardashian. But if we're happy and we feel great and we think we look great, I don't think there's any other medicine that anybody can really give. And, you know, it's all about making yourself happier, but it's making people around us happy. The ones that are close and the ones who you know who care, and then you do get the periphery who are slightly worried, but you think, you know, they've done the Slimming World, the Weight Watchers and things like that, had results, but suddenly it started to creep back. And they'll go back, and that's how they make the money and that type of thing. But we're doing it technically for free, you know. Obviously, I think the main people out there are getting sort of money from Kickstarter and Patreon and things like that, just so they can run things like this. And eventually, I believe you're writing a book about it, are you?
I am. Yeah. It's really slow progress. And I'm wanting to look at the health service and how we, you know, the National Health Service in the UK turned 70 years old last year. And I don't think it's a surprise to anybody if I say that the National Health Service is really sick. It's got a lot of chronic long-term conditions, hasn't it?
Sure.
And the way we're treating the health service is very much the way like we're treating diabetes. You know, we're throwing lots of money in at the other end. We're wanting to find more money for this and more money for that.
Sure.
And we're wanting to know how we can deal with patients when they're in the hospital and how we can provide more space for them. But actually, no one's looking at the other end and preventing all of these people with all these chronic long-term conditions coming into the hospitals in the first place.
Yeah.
No one's looking at that end of it in the way that we're not looking at diabetes and trying to stop the sugar coming in. We're looking at the other end and seeing how much more insulin we can pile on top.
Yeah.
And I think that we could make such huge indents in what's happening with the health service if we actually paid so much more to prevention.
Yeah, prevention.
The problem is, of course, that public health is not a short-term game. Public health is a very long-term game, and you know, if like me, you want to have immediate results, everything happen now, and that's a real struggle, isn't it? So yeah, I am writing a book about that, and it's, as I say, it's slow progress, but I'm looking at all the different areas like obesity and diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
Cancers associated with obesity and Alzheimer's, and how they're actually affecting the health service, how things have changed over the years, and how we might be able to effect change with all these new ideas to the health service. I think when I started out, it was a really simple exercise, but it's grown legs and arms, and it's become a bit of a beast.
Sure.
And I'm trying to tame it whilst doing my own work and everything else as well. So yeah, it's really interesting. It's really interesting to listen to all the different parties involved. And, you know, it's just reminded me that this is quite interesting, that I had a long chat with one of my bosses, who's an orthopaedic surgeon,
mm-hmm.
about exactly this, that we've got lots and lots of patients who come in for hip and knee replacements and other things as well, like shoulders and foot surgery. And they're all on the same medications. And many, many of them are overweight or have diabetes, hypertension, depression and all the rest of it. And I said to him, you know, what if we can get in there during the time of their waiting list and do something to try and combat these things? What if we can come up with some sort of program? And he said, you're not the first person to have this thought, which I mean, that was gutting for a start. I thought, well, hang on a minute. I thought
that's
it was
my idea.
You're not the first person to have this thought. We sat down a while ago and had this idea, this discussion ourselves. But then so many people wanted a piece of it. And so many people said, well, what about our bit? And what about our bit? And what about our bit? That it just became too big a beast.
Yeah.
And he said, and in the end, we just had to sack it because we couldn't control all that. And I thought, oh, is this what's happening? This is the problem. Yeah, everyone's got their own little part, and
everybody wants
really
a piece
difficult.
Of the pie, literally.
Yeah,
and they want the esteem if it goes right, obviously. And also, there's a lot of bureaucracy behind it. You probably know in the NHS, and it's got it. Something will be done, and our children, our children's children, hopefully, you know, will benefit. Of people like yourselves, people being outspoken of and holding their hands up and saying, have you tried this? And, you know, we've been doing it for 20 million years and all that, you know, the sort of the news that we get as sort of in the forums and things like that. I think there will be a time, and I think it's just up, you know, people like us to fly the flag, really.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the more people that do, the better. But I think it's going to be more of a grassroots thing, isn't it? It's going to come up from the bottom rather than, as you say, this very difficult to control lumbering beast that is the NHS.
Yeah, yeah. And do you have concerns with some of the papers and some of the pharmaceutical companies and the cereal companies that you read, if you do your sort of detective work, which a lot of people have, and you find that some papers have been funded by those, so it'll kick in the teeth for low carb or any other type of things that will make you know, well.
I'm never ever surprised when I hear somebody say that this paper or that paper has been funded by this group or that group. It just never comes as a surprise to me. I sat a good few years ago now. I sat in a huge conference in Dublin. And it was about critical care, but it was about evidence base of medicine. And there was a panel of people who were discussing the future of publishing, the future of health publishing and research publishing. And there were a couple of journal, very high profile journal editors there who really just sat very defensively with their arms folded throughout the whole thing and said, you need us.
Mm. Okay.
And I just got more and more wound up as I listened to their argument. You need us. We tell you how things are. And therefore, we're going to put our price on it. We're going to control it. We are the gatekeepers. we also need to put food on our table and feed our families. So yes, you know, we will be looking to be paid for this.
Sure.
And I thought, these guys are just going to, they're going to be left behind, because what's coming is a huge surge of open access, people wanting to get in touch with this and get the hold of this information. You know, this idea of, and so I'm not talking necessarily about sort of who's paying for it all just now. I'm just talking about the journals and publishing mm-hmm. within the journals.
Yeah.
This whole idea of journals having the control is going to be just completely blown out of the water, I think, in the future, because people can just publish their work and give access to whoever needs it.
Yeah.
And what really wound me up was that there was a girl there from South America somewhere who was a doctor who said, you know what, we don't have the money to access your journal. So does that mean that our medical care is going to be not as good as, you know, the optimal? Yes, it does. We can't give our patients what they need or what is the best, what is thought to be the best solution, because you've got it hidden behind a paywall.
Yeah.
And that was one thing that really, really wound me up. And I think that things are going to change, because people are going to start realizing that with the internet, there are other ways to disseminate that information.
Yeah,
get that stuff out there and to share it.
And you've
got, and then, sorry.
Yeah, I was just going to say, on about Dublin, you've got people like Ivor Cummins, who is not from a medical background, who will read the papers and dissect them as an autopsy and really get into the nitty-gritty of what they really mean and if they're right or wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Pros and cons, but,
yeah,
you know, and the power of the internet and people making their own decisions.
People having instant access mm-hmm. and having real-time discussions about these things is going to be a massive shift and a change. It already is, isn't it?
Yeah. Really,
it already is. And I think that's going to have a huge impact. So then where are the likes of the big cereal companies going to go then to yeah. have that control?
Yeah.
That's the next question. And I think, you know, there's this fantastic book, actually, I read a few years ago by a chap called Ryan Holiday, very well known in the States, young lad, who wrote a book called Trust Me, I'm Lying. And it was absolutely fabulous, because it was about his role as a young lad, as a media manipulator, he called himself.
Okay.
And it was all about how we use the media, blogs, influential people to get his message out there. And we've seen some really funny stuff the last couple of weeks, haven't we?
Oh,
this
yeah.
idea of, you know, somebody somewhere put it out that ketogenic diets produce this thing called keto crotch.
Oh yeah, that was, I think that yeah, was you see deliberate, that? Wasn't it?
You know, where yeah. women are going to have terrible trouble down below, you know, with smell and all sorts of problems like that because they have a ketogenic diet. It was absolute utter tosh.
Yeah.
But it was put out there and it was picked up and it went around all the blogs and the different people who are influencers, and it's out there now.
Yeah.
And the only thing that you can do is try and discredit it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
that's harder than actually trying to make it seem real.
Yeah.
And I think that's where that you know, I've seen the words used, information warfare, but that's where it's going.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting that, yes, there's lots of money. I know you asked me about all the money that was coming from the big companies yeah. into the research and what have you, and that's there and that's happening. And I don't know how to control that, because I've been looking at PhDs recently and where I might go with that next.
Yeah.
And the only way to get a funded PhD program is to sell my soul to the likes of Unilever.
Yeah, of course.
Or Kellogg's and the like. And I'm not prepared to do it, but yeah. that's the only way to do it. So as long yeah. as young researchers are taking on PhDs funded by these companies, it's just going to perpetuate, isn't it? It's just going to yeah. keep on going. So I really don't know.
Yeah, unless
where to go with that, how
we
to
all club together
it.
And get you a Patreon account for your for Susie's PhD account fund.
Oh, wouldn't that be great? Love yeah. that. Well, yeah, I can see the funds flowing in for that. But yeah, I mean, that's the huge problem. I mean, there are yeah. PhDs out there, which I think would be really interesting. And all of them say, you know, they're self-funded. You have to provide the funds yourself for this. And that's, you know, that's impossible for
I
me
think,
to do. And that's impossible for the majority of people who would like to be and in, get into research.
Yeah, I think Richard from the Keto Dudes is self, I'm not sure if he's self-funding his own master's or PhD in some sort of biological chemistry because of his interest in, you know, what he's been telling everybody for the last few years on the podcast. So he's sort of really enthusiastic to actually getting the facts and everything. So hats off to him.
Yeah, now, absolutely.
Now, in terms of the our little Carrie Brown was on, and she said, "Oh, I've just been told I'm head of a massive cult in called Keto." But there are lots of people like that, and who in the sort of the low carb community, who are the people that you take notice of?
I think definitely. So at the moment, actually, I've been listening a lot to Vinny Tortorich. Do you know him?
No.
Oh man, you have to go and look up Vinny Tortorich. He's American trainer. I think for years he's been trainer to the stars in Hollywood or something like that. But he promotes a no sugar, no grains diet. He has a fantastic podcast. I think one day a week, he does it like on quite a few days in the week. One day a week, he's very serious, and on a Friday, he speaks to guests and he has, you know, serious conversations. And then other days of the week, he talks utter nonsense, but it's fun and games, and it's all along the no sugar, no grains thing. And I like listening to him. I think his guests have been absolutely fabulous. I tell you what, the two guys in the US, Troy, it's left me. Yeah. Brian Lenskis and Dr. Troy.
Yeah.
They've started the Low Carb MD podcast.
Okay.
And I absolutely adore listening to them. There's enthusiasm it's infectious. I just want to listen to more and more of that. So that's absolutely brilliant, listening to them. I've actually got a lot of time for Sean Baker.
Okay.
Do you know Sean Baker?
No, I'm writing all these down as we speak.
Oh, I'm sorry. If you start listening to these guys, you're going to lose hours of your day.
Oh, no. Well,
Sean Baker is a really interesting guy. He's a US orthopedic surgeon, actually, who started a few years ago on a ketogenic diet. He's a very, very fit chap. He's in his 50s. He rows, I think, and you know, he's very fit. Anyway, he actually has a carnivore diet. Okay. And he gets a lot of attacks on social media, and he replies, which is quite funny to watch. But actually, when you listen to him talking, he knows his stuff.
Yeah.
He has a very open mind, and he has some fantastic ideas and opinions. No matter how crazy you think a carnivore diet is, he's not daft, this chap, and definitely worth a listen to. So that's Sean Baker, him, and I really like listening to Amy Berger talk as well.
Okay. Yeah.
She talks about Alzheimer's and the links there, and that's something that I'm going to go and have a good look at as well.
Brilliant.
So there's quite a few at the moment. I'm a bit of a junkie about all that stuff.
Yeah. Well, I try and cram as much in an hour if I go to the gym, because that's my podcast time. It's not exercise. It's not really punishment. It's an excuse for me to get for these people to get into my head. You know,
I tell you what, it's Tro. It's Dr. Tro Collagen. I don't know how to spell
Tro Collagen. I'll have a look.
Tro Collagen. Well, I tell you what, why don't I? I'll message you with those when I
fabulous, sort of and I'll put it on the show notes and things like that, because I've learned how to use the computer now. No, fabulous. And I always ask my guests on. I've got another question which I'm going to start asking, but my first ones are. In terms of diet and nutrition, have you got a go-to food? Obviously, you're always on the go around a hospital. And if you were cooking for a dinner party and you wanted to do keto by stealth, what would you suggest or what would you cook?
I keep it really, really simple, actually. For myself, I eat a lot of steak and vegetables, meat and vegetables. Okay. Not necessarily expensive ribeye. Yeah. I actually live very close to a shop, and I pop in there about this time of night. So that's a bit unfair for someone listening in the morning, isn't it? But it's getting on for 9 o'clock at night. And I pop in there at the end of the day, and they've often got things like pork leg or beef brisket and that sort of thing that they've marked down at the end of the day. And I go in there, I stick that in the oven for a few hours, and that actually feeds all of us really well. Brilliant. The kids have it with vegetables, and sometimes they have potatoes. They're very happy. Excellent. I have it with my veg, and that's really simple. And actually that suits me at work as well. Amazing. It's quite funny. I went to put my lunch. That was what I made last night, a steak and veg. And I went to put it in a tub to take for my lunch to work today.
Yeah.
And I couldn't find one because I've actually run out, because it's been a very long time since I went to the Chinese takeaway and got a tub. So I thought, oh, I'm going to have to go and have a Chinese one night. And then I thought, oh, no, I couldn't possibly do that. So, yeah, I'm going to have to go and buy some pots.
We're quite fortunate. We've got a Home Bargains at the bottom of our hill. So they do all the Tupperware or whatever it is now. Yeah. That type of thing.
I need to get into a Home Bargains and stock up.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, really, really simple. And actually, the other thing, if I was going to have a dinner party, I'd do the same thing. You know, lots of roasts with veg. Sure. You know, it's just meat and veg, isn't it? It's normal food, and nobody questions it.
No. And nobody... I think I missed the texture of bread, but there's alternatives. I've learned how to make a keto-type bread thing that I can put a burger in between. You know, it's got a bit of carbs in because it's made from almond flour, but who cares? It works, and it's really nice, so...
I haven't really gotten into the keto alternatives in that way, actually. Yeah. I've never made a keto bread or anything. I did hear you mention a fathead dough with sausage rolls, and I thought that's probably a good idea, because if anything, it's not chocolate necessarily that gets me. It's often pastry, like a sausage roll will get me if I see. Oh, yeah. That's the sort of.
In fact, that's what I've made tonight, and they're busily upstairs munching away.
Oh, yeah. But that, you know, that sort of thing, I'd probably give a go. But in terms of feeding other people stealthily, if you're meat and people don't question meat and veg, and that's what I find really funny, is that my diet is meat and veg. What's wrong with that?
Yeah, my mum and dad used to give me that. And then soon as I sort of hit teenagers, and then I think it was 1981, I had my first McDonald's. My brother lived in London, and he said, here's a treat for you. I'm going to blame him now. And I was 13, 14, something like that. And again, we'd just come from a skiing trip, and it was, one McDonald's. They've got two burgers in one. Look at this bread and all this.
It's a revelation.
Yeah, it's a revelation.
There's those big cities are to blame. Yeah. I think Birmingham was where I first saw McDonald's, definitely.
Yeah, and then famous last words, and 20-odd stone later, it went. And in terms of, you mentioned you keep fit you with the karate, and you're still in the Territorial Army.
No, I actually came out when my daughters were born.
Okay.
And because at that time I was working and had the kids, and it was just too much. Actually, my unit went out to Basra and went to Afghanistan, and they did amazing things there, and I missed out on that.
Right.
I wish I'd been able to do that, but life takes different turns, and I didn't get to.
Yeah.
I actually went back to not karate, but a martial art, which I now do with my girls, and that's absolutely fabulous to be able to do that.
Brilliant.
And we're talking now about me becoming an instructor in that as well. So that's super. Oh, the fact that I can do that now is just... And that's, you know, somebody said, we were having the diet conversation at work, and one of the nurses said to me, yeah, but it's because you do all that martial arts. So I'm like, I only do it a couple of hours a week.
Yeah.
I'm not going to lose 35 pounds doing that for a couple of hours a week.
Exactly.
But everyone's so programmed, aren't they, into the
idea of
exercise causes weight loss. But actually, I do all that exercise now because I lost the weight.
I'm exactly the same, and I'm training for my first half marathon in five or 6 weeks. And I've noticed that I was quite hesitant doing, you know, the first sort of little 10Ks here and there. And I realised that I could have gone on forever because I wasn't hitting that wall. The first, I did my self-diagnosis. First couple of times I did too much, and basically I didn't take enough salts in, and so I got a bit of cramp. So yeah. I've got this spray now, which is a magnesium spray. I don't know if it works, but it psychologically for me, it sort of helps, and just getting the right my salt in the diet and things like that. So, and the fact that I'm cooking on fat, literally. And again, reading things like Tim Noakes on running and things like that, and it's really inspiring. And again, it's brilliant. So, and I found I was talking to Sian in the podcast after we'd recorded when we were away, and Sian said, "What you should be asking your guest is, because the podcast is called Key to Happiness, you should be asking, what makes you most happy? Not necessarily about the diet, but, you know, about how your life has changed.
I think I was just possibly going to sound a little bit cliche, but, you know, cliches have happened for a reason.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
And I think it's the amount that I'm able to do with my family.
Yeah.
You know, a couple of years ago, we went up to, we live only 10 minutes away from a ski center, and it had been snowing. We went up there and we were, the kids were actually, the ski wasn't yet ready for skiing, but we were sledging. And I'd done something to my neck and my shoulder and just couldn't keep up. And I just felt awful. I felt it was just one of the worst days. And I went and sat in the car while my husband, who is very fit, was up sledging with the girls, and that was really a down, very low moment.
Yeah.
But to be able to go and do those things with my family now is, and we've got a new puppy, and I take her out running,
wow.
And I, you know, we all go out running together with the dog. To be able to do those things and to see the girls developing, and they're 10 and 11, my girls, so they're not yet grumpy teenagers. I've still got them in my clutches,
yeah.
And we're still, you know, but we can do those things together, and
that's
just the most amazing thing that makes me so happy.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah. And before we wrap up, Susie, you've got to tell us how we get in touch with you and all your bits and pieces in terms of podcasts, social media, where we can, I will put it in the show notes, but we might as well tell the thousands of listeners, I hope, that are listening to this.
Thousands of listeners. The probably best way to get in touch with me is actually on Twitter. Okay. My Twitter handle is EdgeSue, so EdgeSuz. And then I do have an account on Instagram as well, which is doc.edge.
Okay.
And on Facebook, I have a little page called at Edge Against the Grain. I think these all sort of started separately, and I never thought of them as one entity or as me as one entity at this. So it's all a bit higgledy-piggledy. But I do have a podcast, and it's called What If Health. So if you were to search whatifhealth.com or What If Health on Instagram or Twitter, then you'd be able to find me there and send me messages through there.
Oh.
And we just need to keep going with the conversation, don't we? I mean, you know, if something I've said's been absolute nonsense, then tell me.
Anything, because the point of the Key to Happiness podcast is just to, one, it's very conversational. I hope people, it comes across that way, but it's sort of to say that normal people like me and other guests that hopefully are coming on, you can do it, and it's not that hard, and it's just common sense at the end of the day.
Amen. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Totally agree.
Yeah. So, but Susie Edge, thanks ever so much for coming on the podcast. Podcast number 8, and listen in next time for another guest, and we'll see you all soon. Bye for now.